This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Parents in Unit 5 schools in Bloomington will be happy with this news. Superintendent Mark Daniel says the district is canceling plans to redraw school boundaries.
At one point in time, we probably thought we needed redistricting. Now it's more of where are our pockets of concentrated growth.
Daniel also tells Charlie Schlenker the growth includes Towanda Elementary and NCHS. Get a preview of a new grocery delivery service available in Bloomington Normal. Instacart will deliver more than just groceries, too. And hear how a community cancer center butterfly garden and butterfly release is helping more than pollinators and plants, bringing beauty to those who need it. All of that, plus a GLT News update on the way. It's July 17th, 2017. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Parent groups in the Unit 5 school district had already begun sharpening their swords and preparing for a fight over redrawing school boundaries. Unit 5 had expected to go through a long and contentious process late this year, but a study of birth rates and composition of neighborhoods has caused Superintendent Mark Daniel to rethink that task. In this interview with GLT's Charlie Schlenker, Daniel says he's now inclined to use population management tools instead of total redistricting. Daniel praises the consultant, Cropper and McGibbon Demographics, whose work has been very accurate.
Over the course of, he was the previous demographer used, and I look at those numbers that we're currently seeing in our district, and he was very accurate with those numbers.
Within a percent.
Oh, within a percent. And then he continues to, and even as we look at, for instance, just 17, 18, we have preliminary enrollment numbers, and he's very accurate with those as well. So, and one of the things that I found interesting as you look at this overall picture of students and new students coming to your district, you do look at home sales. And home sales, 80% of existing homes, that's what really drives your student population. Yes, we know new homes are going to happen.
And they're going to happen where?
And they're going to happen on the east side. So at least that's what we're hearing from the Planning Commission as well, Regional Planning Commission. We'll bring them more in line to us, with us as well, as we further this discussion. Because, yes, at one point in time, we probably thought we needed redistricting. Overall, looking at the entire district, now it's more of, where are our pockets of concentrated growth, and where are those specific schools that are impacted? With that, we need deeper analysis by McGibbon, Dr. McGibbon, and we'll be moving forward in that area. And those areas would be Towanda and Normal Community High School right now.
So how will you approach that if it's not a full redistricting? What will you do for the hotspots?
Well, those are, then you start asking yourself, what are the options? And for instance, as I look at, we'll start with Towanda Elementary, X number of classrooms, X amount of square footage, i.e. library or auxiliary room. We've already moved into those areas, those spaces. So if we would have a class come in at kindergarten size of, say, 35, which for a kindergarten class at 35, I don't believe we actually have a physical space for those students, we would need to split that class. Well, there are no other rooms. So the question would be then, how do you handle that particular building? You would have to look at, are we open attendance scenarios, volunteer parents, which it's very difficult once a parent moves in a neighborhood. Why would you want a student to move out of that neighborhood? But we might have to look at those configurations. And, you know, you also have to put on the table, what if you would add a few classrooms to that building? So, again, not a new school, but addition to a building. So that's a Towanda scenario. I'd also look at in regards to Normal Community High School. we're looking at, again, how do you perhaps make some adjustments in the student population between Normal Community and Normal West. But again, how do I look at that physical plant? And are there areas where we could repurpose? So it would be some remodeling of the school and perhaps addition of some classrooms. But again, in our economic times, that's pretty tough.
The demographic study indicated that for the next decade or so, you're going to be having a larger high school classes, even as the grade school classes enrollments start to decline.
Correct.
You had earlier been thinking about a full-scale redistricting, and now you're saying that's off the table. What is the break point for that sort of calculation where a full redistricting is needed or these other enrollment management tools or building management tools come into play? What is the decision point?
I think there are several decision points, but one of those decision points would be, first of all, what funding is even available to think about redistricting? Because redistricting is one of those scenarios where, as we've discussed before, when you start moving students from one elementary school to another elementary school, there better be a significant reason why. And usually that's because of capacity of school. So trigger point would be capacity of schools. Another trigger point would be then, as you look at the capacity of schools, do we have or how are we going to attain funding to modify those buildings or in some cases, as in the past in our district where you had such a significant population increase, there was no – that you had to figure out new buildings, and with new buildings comes reconfiguration. So those are the trigger points, I believe. We're fortunate in a way – and I would compare us to other places across the country, as Dr. McKibben said, we are stabilized. We're not decreasing like most districts across the country are.
The nationwide average is about a 10%
decline. Yeah, about a 10% he mentioned.
So over the next decade.
Over the next decade. And that makes sense. You look at our population trends nationwide. You look at the baby boomers. Those, and he even sort of focused on it's not just your you go through stages of student enrollment. So you have the elementary years, then you have the junior high years. Well, once you're a family where you've moved into most years, well, your kids are in the junior high years, you are now empty nesters for the elementary schools. And if neighborhoods are solid, which we do have neighborhoods that we see the population is, i.e. mom and dad are aging, and their students are moving through the system. Those students, that's what we're seeing, the bulge now or the if you will, the bubble coming through the high schools. Because those kids have passed through the elementary. They're now passing through the junior high, and now they're entering the high school. So, but we don't see a large number now entering in the kindergarten level. And that's just part of the trend of our country.
Here's another question, though. It used to be in more prosperous times that the empty nesters then would move. They would buy a smaller house or maybe an upgraded house.
Right.
As they enter their peak earning years,
yes,
as their kids are heading into college and moving onward.
Yes.
Housing velocity nationwide is slowing.
Yes.
What does that do to neighborhoods and the renewal of neighborhoods for school districts?
Well, also, I think that's another important factor. And you do see, and we have neighborhoods in Bloomington Normal. I happen to live in one where we're seeing an aging population. I'm talking senior citizens, and he'd say, basically, there are two reasons why people move out of their homes. And they've already gone through the cycle of maybe they've had the upgrade home, so they still had perhaps junior high or high school kids, and they made a move to a it's not their starter home, it's their second or third home. It's what happens to that population when they have no children in schools, and they'll live until, and it's usually this, it's a death of a spouse.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point in time, that's usually when those neighborhoods start to recycle. Well, we're starting to see some of those neighborhoods even in our Bloomington Normal area. Is it of a large portion? No. That's why we do need to dig in deeper to figure out where are our growth areas. If we have capacity building, capacity issues, what about the growth in there, specifically in their neighborhoods? And can we live with those buildings as they currently are, or do we need to make adjustments?
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Mark Daniel, the superintendent of Unit 5 Schools. Another interesting bit of data from the McKibben report is that the average age of the community is going to rise from 29-ish to more than 32 over the next period of years. So what that's a little unusual, he remarked, for a college town like Bloomington Normal. But what does that say about acceleration of lowering enrollment?
It will not be certainly at the rate where we've been in the past, I'll say past 5 to 10 years, where we had that significant growth. It will stay steady, but it is not going to climb now.
So it doesn't snowball.
It does not snowball.
With a rising age.
With a rising age. And it doesn't snowball on the decrease side as well. So we're going to stay, as I look at the kindergarten or I look at the K through 5 numbers, and he's predicting out, and I'll just give you a prediction out 5 years. So 21, 22, we're looking at about 6587 are the number of students, 6,587. And yet next year, this coming year, we're at 6,577. A 10-student variation actually increased a bit. But if I go way out to the 10-year mark, he's looking at 6,516 students. Okay, so that's a decrease of about, 51 students there. Or 61 students, excuse me. So not a tremendous change. So it tells you again, Bloomington Normal is a very steady community because, again, of all the the very positive trends that we have in regards, this is a place that has quality of life. Now, he also mentioned you are suffering from the curse of a successful school district. What does that mean?
Unpack that, yeah.
So as I listened to this, he said, you produce students, high school graduates, that are of high quality. They do well in their endeavors post high school years. So they do what? They move on, they go to universities and colleges, and sometimes we retain them because of the quality of ISU and Illinois Wesleyan, as well as Heartland, but many of those students move off.
They don't come back.
And they don't come back. And that's the curse of a quality school district, because you have programs where students are successful and they can move out and be successful basically any place they want to go.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Mark Daniel is our guest today. He's the superintendent of Unit 5 Schools. Does the enrollment trend of stable to slightly down call into question any of your building placement choices in recent years, the Benjamin Elementary, you know, the Far East Side or South Side schools?
Well, as I look at those buildings, they are also Benjamin is reaching some capacity issues in their elementary. We may have to look at that in the very near future. I don't think you ever stop analyzing the capacity issues you have in your buildings, which then might lend to some adjustments in either open enrollment, which is the least impactful for families, because we'd say, okay, you're a kindergartner, you haven't already started into the building. It's as you come into that neighborhood, this is where we're going to have to divert you, because we do have overcrowding in that class, those classes, and we can't handle that. Or it would cause such a number that we have to split that class, and now we need two classrooms where, in fact, just like Tawanda Elementary, there aren't two classrooms left. There's not another classroom left. So I would say the placement, although we would probably have a much longer discussion, Evans is, as the growth happens, do we see a lot of growth happening on the east side to where we're talking new schools? I don't believe that's going to be the case. But I will say this. Existing homes are the foundation, as we talked, 80%. That's really the number driving. In our older neighborhoods, they need to, they will continue to turn over and be populated. So we're fairly accurate in where our schools are placed. The question also is what programs, special programs, sit in those schools. That's a question. I know we had talked about Title I previously, and because of your question, I actually investigated that a bit. It would not behoove us. We could not spread our programs across the district, and there would be no gain in reimbursement from the federal level.
So you've not done that analysis.
Yes, we did.
Okay.
But, you know, I appreciate your digging into that a bit, because it did create some thought and some thinking process on that, saying, and I'll tell you why.
So Fairview will continue to be a relatively high poverty rate.
High poverty with the community center available. And there you have a specific program that's being implemented in that building to serve those specific needs and the needs of that greater neighborhood area. I'll talk to Cedar as well. High population of Hispanic students, and we have special programming there. If we tried to spread that out, well, we might think of north-south, but to do that throughout every building, we would not have enough manpower and programming staff to be able to implement.
Unit 5 Superintendent Mark Daniel spoke with GLT's Charlie Schlenker. The demographic study suggests Bloomington Normal will grow older on average over the next decade, and K-12 enrollment will drop less than 1.5% by the year 2027. You're listening to Sound Ideas on 89.1 FM, GLT, and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.
Support for GLT's Sound Ideas comes from Justin M. Boyd, Country Financial Representative, building relationships while supporting and serving the community. Justin offers life insurance options designed to protect your family and leave a lasting legacy. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
Coming up, you'll hear about Instacart. The online-based company will deliver groceries and more in Bloomington Normal. That interview is on the way during Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Governor Bruce Rauner's response to the veto override of the state budget is causing consternation in his own party. That's the verdict from panelists on the Illinois Politics Roundtable, including moderator Sean Crawford, IPR's Brian Mackey, Chris Mooney, the director of the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois, and Crane's Chicago business politics writer Greg Hines. Hines notes there have been big changes in the governor's office in the wake of passage of a state budget. Rauner jettisoned his chief of staff, communications director, and others.
Well, we kind of wondered after last week, after the overrides, what Rauner would do, whether he would kind of rest on his laurels and just run against the evil Democrats and their tax increase, but since he tried to get along until election time, or whether he'd double down and go back to the mats. Well, we now know the answer. He's doubling down. He's bringing in a whole series of folks, mostly from the Policy Institute, who frankly had considered Bruce Rauner to be a liberal sympathizer. It was only 3-4 weeks ago that the governor's new chief of staff, Ms. Rasmussen, was publicly criticizing him for playing footsie with the Democrats on a possible tax increase. Well, those are the guys who are now going to control the governor's press operation, his chief of staff operation, other parts of the government. So he's kind of in. This governor was not inclined to compromise most of the time. Well, now he's in more of an echo chamber than ever, and it means we're going to have very interesting times to come. The budget wars are not over, folks.
The Illinois Policy Institute. Brian, what is that organization, and why has it got people so interested here in these changes?
Yeah, it's a group that I've called them an advocacy organization in my reporting. They style themselves a think tank, but they do a number of things. They have a wing that sues people and governments on behalf of legislation they want to see. They've filed the lawsuit that's challenging the union's so-called fair share fees, that where state workers, even if you don't join the labor union, you have to pay fees. They have a wing that does campaign-type work, a true political action committee. And then they have this wing that publishes a lot of op-eds, and they have a news service that they send free news stories that are picked up in a lot of smaller, more mid-sized and smaller newspapers across the state. They recently bought a radio network within the last year or two. And, you know, the policies they advocate are pretty conservative. There was, I'm thinking back over the years, there was an op-ed at one point that advocated for the governor to fire every state worker and rehire them so that they could be given lower retirement benefits. I mean, this is definitely a pretty far towards the right end of the political spectrum. And they, I should also add, their budget proposal this year is not, it wasn't widely adopted, but it, or picked up by politicians, but it suggested that you could balance the budget with deep, deep, deep cuts and no tax increases. Very little buy-in to that concept, though, from legislators on both sides of the aisle.
Chris Mooney?
Yeah. The sort of ideological perspective of this group, and we, you know, call them conservative, very conservative. I think there's no doubt that that's true, and they would embrace that. But they're not, you know, the conservative movement in this country really has a sort of two wings, and one of them is, you know, sort of driven by the Christian right, very focused on moral issues, you know, abortion in particular, sort of the thing they've been running with for quite a few years, and then you've got this sort of libertarian arm, you know, the sort of Rand Paul followers of Ayn Rand, for example, and who are really not so much concerned with the moral issues. They're concerned with the economic issues. And in fact, I mean, some of the extreme writers in this world think of the economic issues as moral issues, but not in the same way that sort of people on the far left would think of economic issues as moral issues. They're thinking that, you know, that free enterprise is, you know, is the goal of all. That liberty is a word you hear them talking about. They want freedom. They want the government off their back. They want to, you know, deconstruct the administrative state, as you know, Steve Bannon talked about. And the Illinois Policy Institute, my read on, you know, what they have, you know, their message put out, it falls into that more of that libertarian camp, and you know, though. The reason we're talking about this right now, usually this is the most inside of baseball, and nobody cares who's on the governor's staff except for, you know, people actually having to work with them. But, you know, what this demonstrates is that the governor is, you know, he's all in on that side. I mean, I think we've known that he is, you know, a strong free market guy all along, but now suddenly he's bringing these people in. They bring nothing to the table other than ideological purity. I mean, they don't have any experience in government for the most part. They don't have a lot of experience in campaigns. They don't have connections, working connections, really, with the general mass of people working in and around state government. So that's was his choice.
Greg,
yeah,
what?
I think
go
it,
ahead.
I think it, those are some really good points. And let me just add one other one to the list before we go on. What's really the core of all this is, how do you bring change to a state that clearly needs some change? I think Democrats and Republicans on both sides of the aisle agree that the state's economy isn't what it should be. We need to make some changes. But these kinds of changes, the kinds of changes that the Policy Institute and now the governor's new staff want, aren't changes as much as a revolution. They're dramatic, incredible, over the top changes. I don't consider that conservative. Conservatives take their time, and they take what they can get, and they digest, and then they do a little bit more. This is really radical. That's a word that Rasmussen had used.
Well, Greg, let me ask you this: when it comes to Bruce Rauner, because I would say he's a smart fellow. He knows what he wants. Why does he need the Policy Institute in there to tell him what he wants? Did his other staff members just not do a good enough job?
You know, that's a really good question, and I can't quite get into the governor's head. I can tell you that it is a pretty well-known secret around the Capitol that the governor was very unhappy with his press staff. He blamed them for the bad message, much in a way kind of like Donald Trump's blaming his press people. They've all been now replaced, with one exception who's still there, and I'm not sure how long she's going to be there. If she has a resume, I'd get it out if I were her. He clearly has chosen not to try to work this out in any way at this point and take it to the voters in 2018. He's going to go down and fight like heck and get every last thing. And the question is, how much China and collateral damages are going to be in the meantime. The big piece of the budget that really wasn't done was school funding. The Democrats included some money in the budget, but they also passed a revamp of the school funding formula that he's threatened to veto. Well, if he does that, the schools may not open, or if they do open, they may not stay open long, like the summer or in the fall. And now you have this new cast of characters who are telling the governor, don't compromise, stick to your guns. You know, if there's damage, so what? We have to have our revolution here.
I think this does fit in to the general political philosophy that we've seen from the Rauner camp for a few years now, where they think the major divide, at least among their base, is insider versus outsider, right? And they talk about I've talked to some strategists who say that that's what President Trump rode to Washington, and Governor Rauner has tried to do the same thing here, that it's not really Democrats and Republicans or conservatives and liberals, that what animates a lot of voters these days is this idea of insider versus outsider. And we've already seen that in the messaging this week. Well, the Policy Institute, it's true, they are outsiders in Springfield. Even they have ideas that have been put into bill form, but it's not like they are particularly influential in terms of getting their legislative agendas drafted into law. Their ideas have been outsider ideas. And so it seems that the governor is, as we said, doubling down on this strategy that he is going to run against not just Speaker Madigan and the politicians he controls, but even the Republicans in Springfield, perhaps. And we saw that in his messaging right after he vetoed the budget before he had been overridden in the House. He was asked a question about, what do you think about, why did you're saying it's Speaker Madigan's tax hike, but there were 16 legislative Republicans who helped vote for it and get it into law. And he said, you know, the politicians on both sides have been doing the wrong thing for too long. So this plays into his messaging, whether that, Donald Trump lost Illinois by a pretty wide margin. So whether that works in a general election context here is an open question.
Chris, let me ask you, because Greg mentioned, too, about he'll have people who will be saying, stick to your guns. What's wrong with that? You're going into really what is a battle here. You want people on the same page as you, I would guess. So if he feels these people are on the same page, is that a bad thing for the governor?
Well, you certainly want your staff to be on your side. They need to be extensions, staff as opposed to even, agency directors. Staff are really just direct extensions of the governor's eyes, ears, and hands and feet. I mean, they are supposed to represent, and they have to have, clear loyalty. That's their one and only job, is to represent the principal. And I don't think there's anyone that would argue that the former staff was anything but that. I mean, they were super loyal. They were, they were tough. There was complaints about that they were all campaign staff and they weren't governing staff and they didn't know how to govern, but they knew how to campaign. There was that. But no, so the whole thing, it has the appearance of panic to me. And I don't really know what's going on. Again, Greg, I have no idea what's going on in Bruce Rauner's head, but. He has the veto override, and he had a choice at that moment. And he could either say, he had many choices, but two that he could say, they overrode my veto. They're causing a tax increase. I'm going to drive that home. I'm going to take that to the bank in commercials that they've, and all the while I'm using the money of the tax increase to shore up government, to fix things, to do all the things that governors normally do to make themselves popular among the state. So he could have really, and I think there was a lot of comment on this in the media about how this looked like it was probably a win. I mean, the override was probably a win for Rauner. But he interpreted it a different way and sort of immediately throws everybody out, gets in the new group, goes to the mattresses, doesn't go to find people that can help him cooperate and to work with others in the group, goes and really isolates himself, even within the Republican Party. I think it's pretty clear that the sort of IPI, libertarian wing of the Republican Party, is not the mainstream of the Republican Party by any stretch of the imagination, especially in the state of Illinois.
Greg, I'm going to give you the last chance on this, but maybe the more moderate wing of the Republican Party, any idea how they're viewing these changes?
Well, I don't think they're happy at all. I talked to probably a dozen high-ranking Republicans in the last few days, all of them would fit what Bruce Rauner, I guess, would call insiders, and they are just aghast. One head of a major group, for instance, says that if Rauner keeps doing this, his chances of winning a new term have gone from pretty good a week ago to zero.
Greg Hines is the political writer for Crane's Chicago Business. Joining him on the Illinois Politics Roundtable were Chris Mooney, the director of the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois, IPR Statehouse reporter Brian Mackey, and moderator Sean Crawford. You're listening to Sound Ideas on GLT. Sound Ideas, I'm Mike McCurdy. Grocery stores have been offering online shopping and delivery services for years now, but of late, separate companies have begun offering the same service using the stores. Vendors such as Fresh Shop, Ocado, Grub, and Grubhub are making inroads. Some investment firms are projecting a 79% growth in the total U.S. home delivery market over the next 5 years. And there's a new player in Bloomington Normal. Instacart just began service in the Twin Cities and in Peoria last week, offering same-day delivery service. Victor Savache is an area manager for Instacart. Savache tells GLT's Charlie Schlenker his outfit is rapidly growing as well.
We are in over 50 cities in the U.S., and our goal is to be able to reach over 80% of American households by next year. So really, it's super simple to use. If you're a customer, you can go on our website, instacart.com, or download our app, our mobile app, the Instacart app, and you'll select your favorite grocery store that you like to shop from. And what we do is we partner you with one of our personal shoppers. They'll get your order, and they'll go ahead and they'll shop the order and deliver the order at the time that you request it. For the first 30 days that we're launching here in Bloomington, we're offering a free membership, an express membership for all new users. And what that is it's a free delivery service, unlimited deliveries for the year.
How expensive is a membership in normal times?
So in regular times, it's $14.99 a month or $149 per year.
One of the challenges to online delivery services is that the people who most need it, the elderly, the people without transportation, the sick, are least able often to access and use the internet. How is that surmountable?
So that's a little bit of a misconception here, because although we do help, we do serve, you know, elderly or people who are disabled or injured, we serve all types of people. So there's a lot of folks who are, you know, parents who would have that have young children that it makes it difficult for them to go to the grocery store. Also, you know, just working parents who or just working people who want to come home and spend the little time that they do have at home doing things that they enjoy, spending time with their kids, or just not doing the chore of grocery shopping. But going back to your original question, we have had many customers who shopped for their grandmothers, or they shop for, you know, someone that has that need. And we even have some customers that do it across the state. So we had one customer in Denver who ordered online and does it weekly for her grandmother in California. So we've seen several examples like that. But we also have a lot of customers who are offices, companies. So usually like office administrators, office managers, you know, that's time for them that they save working in their office, getting work done versus going to the store and buying the coffee, the snacks, the water, the things like that for the office. So I know here in Bloomington, we have a couple big companies like State Farm, which I think is going to be one of our customers who, if they try our service, I think they're really going to enjoy it. But also, they'll gain a lot more time back in their day.
Obviously, you make money from the memberships. Is there also a per delivery fee?
So, yeah, correct. So the delivery fee is $5.99 per delivery for an order of $35 or more. But we also have other revenue streams with other companies who will advertise on our websites, so other things like that.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Victor Savache, an area manager for the startup in this area, at any rate, delivery company Instacart. How crowded is this concept getting? We've seen Uber, an app-based taxi service, and there are lots of restaurants that have delivery services, but not so many like you that have a collection of stores and services under your umbrella that you can choose and have it delivered as sort of a larger package of things.
I think it's rapidly growing. So, like, I'll take our company, for example. Right now, we're in about 50 cities. I started with this company a little under a year ago, and we were only in around 25 cities. So we've almost doubled our size. And if you just look at the online grocery delivery landscape in this country, less than 2% of Americans have used online grocery delivery. So that leaves tons of room for growth. That's what we're doing here in Bloomington. You know, we've been in Chicago for a few years now, but we're not only launching in Bloomington, but all of Central Illinois, Springfield, Carbondale,
Peoria.
So we're, and I think there's just more room to grow. So we're definitely going in that direction. And Instacart has established themselves as the industry leader in online grocery delivery.
Amazon just bought Whole Foods. How are you going to respond to that challenge?
So I can't really speak to that. I don't have a lot of information to that. What I can tell you is that we have a lot of partnerships with other retailers. We're super excited to launch here in Bloomington and the rest of the Midwest. And just a couple stores that I can mention here, the stores that we serve in Bloomington is the Chinooks, Binny's, Petco, and the CVS locations. So if you go on our website, you'll see all of those stores. You'll be able to select whichever grocery store, whatever store you like to shop from, and we'll deliver that for you.
Food, alcohol, prescription drugs. What other sectors do you serve?
So if you go walk into the Chinooks or the CVS, really all types of like health and body stuff. So toothpaste, mouthwash, paper towels, paper plates. Really what you can find in the store, most of those items you're going to find in the catalog on our site.
You're going to expand to hardware or other kinds of things?
You know, I can't really speak to that, but I think it's a possibility. Right now, our focus is grocery. Who knows what the future could hold with that?
What's the incentive for someone to pay the delivery fee? What's the price point and the opportunity gain from their time? You got to have some income,
right,
to make this a choice.
Right. And, you know, I think there's we've had customers who've told us that, you know, the delivery fee is it's worth it because the biggest thing that you can't get back is your time. And for a lot of folks, it's a chore. You know, it's a 2-hour chore to get in the car. If you have kids, get the kids in the car, go to the store, wait in lines. And it's just something that now what we're giving people is their time back. And that there's a small price for that. But, you know, we have thousands and thousands of customers who enjoy that, and now they're spending those few hours a week doing whatever it is that they love.
What's the incentive for a Schnucks or a CVS or some other firm to sign an agreement with you?
We've been in this industry for going on 5 years now. If you go on our site, go on our app, you'll see how user-friendly it is. And we have all the experts on our team. So for one of our other partners to start from the ground up, they don't really want to wait. You know, they don't know if they start from the ground up, is it going to work out as well as we have our system? So we're already established, and they hit the ground running partnering with us.
Does the grocery store benefit just by increasing sales of people who might not have otherwise come in, or is there some other incentive that you give them for partnering with you?
No, absolutely. They see the sales. They definitely see the sales, and I think that's the number one reason.
hard good retail sales have increasingly been affected by the internet over the last decade. In fact, it's caused malls in many parts of the country to come under pressure, and retail store chains like Macy's to close outlets in Bloomington Normal. How much of the entire commercial sector is going to be online?
You know, I don't think, and I would just bring it back to grocery, I don't think the grocery stores are going to go extinct. They're going to be around. But there's no question that things are going to change. And the way you walk into a grocery store and you look at that now, that's going to change 5 years from now, 10 years from now. It's going to look different. It's going to be more digital. There's going to be more options for you to shop, you know, through your apps, through your devices. And we're just trying to stay ahead of that change, ahead of that curve, and helping our retail partners, you know, along the way.
The greatest time savings for individual customers would be in major markets, because that's where transportation takes the most time and presents the most hassle, in crowded urban centers where rush hour is a problem. Where does the trade-off become less efficient for you? Where's the smallest market that you would consider serving?
You know, I think probably one of the more rural areas that make it difficult for our shoppers to, like, go to the store and shop and do the deliveries, and if it's not that efficient. So I think that's something that we'll probably try to get there sometime soon. But right now, the smaller markets like the Bloomingtons and Peorias, we can definitely do. There's definitely a market out here for us. And the reason we are out here is because customers have gone to our website, entered their zip code, and we keep track of those things. So we know there's a demand out here, so that's why we've come out here.
Victor Chavachet is an area manager for the online grocery store, drug and alcohol delivery service, Instacart. He spoke with GLT's Charlie Schlinker. Investment firms say they project online grocery delivery to rise from $43 billion this year to $76 billion in 2022. And online delivery usage is booming not just for millennials, but also for the 35 to 44 age group. It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Butterflies in the garden not only help us by pollinating plants, they can inspire us in our darker moments and bring hope to those who need it most. Laura Kennedy has more in this edition of the GLT Datebook.
The Community Cancer Center in Normal is holding a butterfly release coming up Saturday, July 22nd. Master gardener Sue Farrell-Stroyan and Peggy Swerdlick, garden volunteer at the Cancer Center, say this is an expression of hope and peace. Farrell-Stroyan says they were inspired to do this event after seeing their very first butterfly release at the Simmons Cancer Institute in Springfield.
And we were just mesmerized. We thought that'd be a great way to christen our garden at the Community Cancer Center here. So we contacted the people. There are butterfly farms in Florida. It's really important to get a reputable butterfly farm.
Wait a minute, you mean there's disreputable butterfly farms out there?
Well, I don't know that. I don't know that. But we did a lot of research that the monarchs are taken care of really well there. They work closely with the Department of Agriculture. They have to approve our site before they send the monarchs here. The monarchs come in an origami envelope that is carefully folded, and you need to be very careful opening it. They take great care in sending the monarchs here that they will be healthy and go on to live a great life. We released 350 last year at the Community Cancer Center, and most of those stayed at the center and the neighborhoods around. They created new monarchs. A monarch's life cycle is just 1 month, and usually, typically in Illinois, we have 3 generations, June, July, and August. But it's been so hot in the fall, we have 4 generations now.
And I can speak to the beauty of that release with the number of people. When we said 1, 2, 3 and release, hundreds of those butterflies flew up in the air, twirled around, and landed on a lot of the flowers that we have. But I live not too far away. And sure enough, I had over 50 caterpillars and raised monarchs in my yard just because I was close to the Community Cancer Center. So that was a real good thing for me, too. I have a lot of activity at my house. And really, we saw many, many, many monarchs stick around in our environment at the Community Cancer Center on our campus, which, you know, was the purpose, is to allow our patients and our the families of patients to enjoy them too.
Peggy, what do the butterflies represent?
They represent freedom and happiness, their flight. To me, they also represent a kind of a renewal, a life cycle, which all ties into what we try to do with the Community Cancer Center. Renewal, hope, a sense of peace. So they are quite meaningful to a lot of people.
Who can we expect at the butterfly release on the 22nd? Will there be patients there as well as other members of the community who have actually made a donation in order to release a butterfly?
Yes, that's a good question. Patients, the staff, their families of patients, and people who are interested in monarchs. Last year we had about 350 people. Many people, monarch lovers, children. We hope this year to get as many children as we can. We've initiated and created many activities for children to play. We have a huge lawn area.
One of my friends brought her two-year-old, her nephew, and as the butterfly was released, he landed on his cheek, and he turned to her and said, "He just kissed me." So the magic of children and how they react to the release, it was wonderful to view. And so we've decided we'll kind of beef up our activities for children.
So what do you have planned for kids?
We have someone in our group who's an expert with bubbles. We have giant
bubbles. And
giant butterflies. Bubbles coming out of everywhere. And folded, we're going to make an origami folded butterfly. The zoo is lending us their great board, life cycle board, to you can actually put your face in the face of a monarch and take a picture.
We also will have some lemonade and cookies, as well as we have two musicians from our community, and one will be singing some Disney songs before the ceremony actually starts, and then there'll be another person that will be singing after the release. We have registration from 9 to 9:30. If the listeners would like, they can go to the communitycancercenter.com and register. They can purchase a butterfly in memory or in honor of someone. We are selling those for $25. They don't need to purchase. They are welcome to come and enjoy the moment with us. We will release at 10 o'clock. We'll have a ceremony, a short ceremony. We'll have music, and then we will release the butterflies. We hope to release them on the flowers that we have there. And then there'll be music and activities afterwards. So it's a good day for a family.
In the last year, there was a large percentage of monarchs that were diminished, maybe more than half their population, due to climate change, pesticides, and deforesting. So we really believe, as does this butterfly farm in Florida, that we are keeping them in a safe environment, free from pesticides and germs, and releasing them and many more of their family on to go on their journey.
So for folks who are actually living in the vicinity of the Cancer Center who might have extra monarchs floating around, what are some of the ways we can encourage them, keep them alive, and keep them hanging around here?
Certainly by planting as many annuals and perennials in your garden. That for sure will bring a colorful display and be a good place to land. Butterflies like almost a little landing pad on the flower. Coneflower, a daisy, is a good example of that. So they love perennials. They love annuals. A good butterfly garden has about two-thirds perennials and a third annual.
Can we plant milkweed? Because I know that they like milkweed.
They love milkweed, yeah. And there are different kinds of milkweed. Maybe the milkweed you're thinking about is the milkweed you'd commonly see in farm fields that farmers spray.
Yes.
But there are different kinds of milkweeds. Butterfly weed is one, swamp milkweed. We use an annual plant called bloodflower that's both a host and nectar plant for the monarch butterfly. It's a really great one, and we find the monarchs lay their eggs on that one more than any other.
And, you know, when they lay their eggs, then they eventually turn into caterpillars. And I was looking at a documentary about the flight of monarchs, and I learned that almost only 2% survive these caterpillars. So it's a good idea if you see the caterpillar and you have something to feed them, like milkweed, mm-hmm. you can bring them in the house and raise them.
A little pet pre-monarch.
Right. The primary purpose is to really let the community know that they are welcome This is the Community Cancer Center, and they are welcome to our campus. We have, since the addition, we have established this beautiful campus that is very restful, very peaceful. We have a lovely water feature. We have a labyrinth, and then the butterfly garden expands the length of the building. And those are all open to the public. It's right off the trail. And, you know, we want the community to know about this. This is a garden that we'd like to share.
And we'd like to say that the butterfly garden was created by Master in a partnership with the Master Gardeners and the Cancer Center. We studied 10 butterflies, their host and nectar needs, and created the garden with those plants.
And in doing so, we became a monarch way station, which is nice news for the monarchs. If they're flying through, they know they've got some place to feed. And we've also become a pollinator pocket.
Oh, we're so a pollinator pocket there at the Cancer Center.
Yes. When you're there, not only can you see the butterflies, but you can hear the birds and the wind through the trees. It's just a...
Very calming.
Very calming, which is good for our patients and good for their families and good for all of us who work there.
That's Peggy Swerdlick and Sue Farrell-Stroyan. The Community Cancer Center's butterfly release is coming up Saturday, July 22nd. The ceremony will begin at 10 a.m., and all the money raised goes back to the Community Cancer Center. I'm Laura Kennedy.
In addition to monarch butterflies, the Community Cancer Center's butterfly release will include the Eastern Tiger Swallowtail, Viceroy, Red Admiral, Painted Lady, and more. You can find past editions of the GLT Datebook at our website, WGLT.org. The website is also where you can find past editions of Sound Ideas, including this episode with help from Laura Kennedy and Charlie Schlinker. We want to know what you think of Sound Ideas. Share your thoughts at Facebook.com/WGLTFM or tweet about the show. Use the hashtag Sound Ideas. I'm at Mike McCurdy. We're all at WGLT News. This is WGLT Normal, Bloomington Normal's public media.